Chapter 74. The Near East Blindfolded. The British establishment had promised Hussein, the Emir of Hejaz, independence, land and wealth if he would turn against the Ottomans. London sent one of its agents masquerading as an archaeologist to infiltrate the nomadic Arabs. Known as Lawrence, he had adapted himself to the local customs, had dressed like an Arab and become known as a promiscuous homosexual. For 3 years he would tirelessly play the British card in Arabia. The Turks would make him pay dearly when they eventually captured him, he would be tortured and brutally sodomized. After the war the British would not treat him much better, he died in a mysterious motorcycle accident in England. Lawrence had managed to subordinate the Arabs to London's policy. Hussein was given £20,000 sterling, an enormous bribe in those days of sand, camels, dates and clear oasis water. At the same time, and equally in secret, another £20,000 were slipped into the pocket of Ibn Saud, the Wahhabi chieftain and main rival of Hussein. This policy of divide and conquer with which the British had pitted all the European countries against one another for centuries was now being applied in Arabia. After using the Arabs against the Turks, the British intended to reap the benefits of the discord they had sown among rival Arabs, namely, assuming control of all the oil fields in the Middle East. Every sheikh and emir was bribed or manipulated into bitter feuds from 1915 to 1918. With the Turks out of the picture in 1919, Arab daggers would turn against each other while the British would be free to exploit the newly discovered oil. The wars and conflicts that have racked the Middle East ever since, and could well provoke World War III, are a direct result of British policy in that region, including one of the few promises kept, the creation of Israel out of the ancient land of Palestine. In 1915 the Arabs had full confidence in the British. They were impressed by plumed-hatted emissaries bearing gifts and promises as well as the excellent British public relations which preceded each encounter. Tales of amazing victories would be told to wide-eyed sheikhs, who would then pass them on with even more embellishment. The British imported Indian regiments to fight alongside the Arabs against the Turks. Hussein was delighted to see the anti-Turkish troops advancing towards Mosul and Damascus. Poetically he would say, "I am a fish swimming in the sea, the larger the sea the larger the fish." He dreamed of a unified Arabia under his rule. Other Arab sheikhs who had participated in the British campaign thought likewise. The Turks were finally defeated and capitulated at Mondros on October 30, 1918. The British received the terms of surrender, but they did not bother to inform their allies of it. The French, the Italians, the Greeks, and the Arabs were kept in the dark until the first weeks of the Paris Peace Conference. Everybody who had been railroaded into the war by London was coming to claim his reward. For the Arabs it was independence, for the Greeks, Italians, French and Jews it was land. First Venizelos rushed to Paris, accompanied by a shady oil financier called Basil Zaharoff, who was later knighted by the British monarch, George V. On May 6, 1919 Venizelos was authorized by the conference to send a division to Smyrna. On May 16 the Greeks landed and occupied Smyrna with a party of 20,000 men and proceeded to massacre the Turkish population. William Lynn Westerman recalled, "The most moderate evaluation allows us to state that more than 2,000 Turks men, women and children were uselessly put to death." What happened in Paris, page 159. After this brilliant beginning for the democracies, Greek troops massacred more Turks in Aden as they advanced into the heartland of Asia Minor. Churchill explained the campaign, "Greeks wished to destroy the Turkish army and occupy Ankara." World Crisis, Volume 4, page 394. It was at this desperate time in Turkish history that an unknown man appeared. The Greeks had taken the railway lines around Ankara and only had 70 miles to go before entering the city. The providential savior of Turkey was called Mustafa Kemal. A no-nonsense military man who had fought the British and Russians with great valor, he took it upon himself to organize Turkish resistance against the foreigners after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. Like Marshal Joffre at the Marne in 1914, Mustafa Kemal had decided to stand fast at any cost. The Greek army continued to pound Turkish positions, and managed to advance some 15 miles more at a tremendous cost in lives. 30,000 men fell within a week of combat. Both sides were exhausted, but Kemal managed to rally his troops for a counterattack. After 3 days of furious fighting, the Greeks were forced to retreat. They held on to the east of Smyrna and Aden with dwindling supplies, and appealed for help to their British sponsors. The British cabinet was in no mood to help the Greeks, whom it had railroaded into this frightful mess and to whom it had promised Turkish territory. The Greeks had served their purpose, and they were going to be left on their own. Churchill said, "The Greeks are approaching bankruptcy. In fact, it is none of our business." He added that he had heard that this was the view of his allies. "We have had enough of this. On one side one hears the screams of someone drowning, and on the other there is the good advice of a spectator who has not the slightest intention of getting wet." The Greek drowning was horrible. Acting on the momentum of their counterattack, the Turks reconquered Smyrna in an orgy of blood, like the Mongolian hordes of old. Few people escaped the massacres. Ears and breast nipples were chopped off and displayed by the hundreds on lengths of wire. Atrocities of gruesome barbarity were committed everywhere. The Greeks suffered one of the worst massacres and defeats in their history because they had set out to get what had been promised to them by the invincible British. Belatedly, Churchill pronounced what amounted to a tragic mea culpa. The return to Europe of the triumphant Turks, thirsting after Christian blood, constituted, after all the events of the Great War, the worst humiliation for the Allies. Nowhere had victory been so complete as in Turkey, nowhere had the power of the victors been so arrogantly defied. The achievements, the laurels for which so many thousands of men had died on the rocks of Gallipoli, in the sands of Mesopotamia and Palestine, in the swamps of Salonika, on the ships that supplied these vast expeditions, all the sacrifices made by the Allies in men, arms, and money, all that was marred with shame. The lofty pretensions of Europe and the United States, all the eloquence of their statesmen, the humming of their committees and commissions had led the masters of the world to this ignominious end. World Crisis, Volume 4, page 183. Ionia, the Greece of Asia, was no more. 1,250,000 Greek refugees fled to Greece. Among them was a young boy of 11 named Aristotle Onassis, who would later give Greek shipping great prominence. If this could be considered a benefit to Greece, it was the only one that came out of the ill-fated campaign. The Italians had watched the Greek debacle with interest. The lesson was not lost on them. Consequently, they lowered their sights, focusing on what they could take, not what had been promised to them by London. They were neither ready nor willing to sacrifice 500,000 men for far-off lands in Asia Minor, and would wisely occupy only a few Dodecanese islands. Now that the Greeks and the Italians had lost their appetite for the feast, the question became, who was going to dine? Article 12 of Wilson's 14 Points envisaged, the Turks of the Ottoman Empire should constitute a sovereign and independent nation, and the non-Turks should enjoy the right of autonomy. The non-Turkish territories had been promised to the Arab Sheikh Hussein by the British in 1915. General Allenby, the British commander in Asia Minor, made an official declaration confirming this commitment as soon as the Turks had capitulated. The French and British governments promised to help and encourage the establishment of indigenous governments in Syria and Mesopotamia. These governments would be the expression of the free will and initiative of the people concerned. What happened in Paris, page 161. The American delegate William Westerman states, this solemn promise was not honored. And for good reasons. While the British were promising a kingdom worthy of Harun al-Rashid to the Arab sheikhs, they were secretly signing an agreement with the French government to share the entire Middle East. Known as the Sykes-Picot Protocols, the agreement would give Syria, a non-oil country, to the French and the whole of Mesopotamia, a land rich in oil, to the British. The Arabs, who had waged a costly holy war of liberation for 3 years, found themselves well behind the eight ball. Wilson seemed surprised that the British could engage in such double dealing and made known his displeasure. The United States of America do not support the claims of Great Britain and France on people who do not wish their protection. One of the fundamental principles consistently followed by the United States is the respect of popular will. In consequence, the United States want to know whether the Syrians agree to be under French rule, and whether the Mesopotamians agree to be under British rule. This may not be the United States' business, but since this matter is submitted to the peace conference, the only way to deal with it is to find out what the people in these regions want. World Crisis, page 359. Wilson proposed that a commission be created to study the subject. The Allies gladly accepted, knowing full well it would have no bearing on the final outcome. Churchill, who called such a commission an old woman's remedy, was not concerned that after a long tour in the Middle East the commission reported that none of the countries concerned wished to see a foreign presence and that they all wanted nothing less than full independence. The British interpreted the commission's findings as meaning that the people of the Middle East wanted to avail themselves of British rule. After some acrimonious haggling with the French, who felt themselves cheated of oil, the British would give the French the 25% of the stock which the Germans had invested in companies exploring for petroleum during their construction of the Berlin-Baghdad Railway before the war. A pipeline would carry 25% of the oil obtained by British drilling from Mosul to the French in Syria. The French still felt cheated but accepted the British offer as better than nothing. The government sent troops to occupy Syria and expel the king and his family. Opposition was suppressed by force of arms. The British got the lion's share of the Middle East and successfully managed to keep the French quiet with German stocks and Arab land. The Arabs were not even a factor in the British partition of the Near East. If the Italians, Greeks and Arabs had been used and shortchanged, the Armenians suffered 100 times more. Before the war they had suffered frightful persecution at the hands of the Turks, who would not tolerate a non-Turkish people living near their Caucasus borders. Hundreds of thousands were massacred by bloodthirsty Turkish hordes, while equal numbers were hunted out of their homes and villages and driven into trackless deserts, and left to die from thirst and hunger. Churchill noted that, it is estimated that 1.2 million were thus eliminated, more than half the entire Armenian population. It was an organized crime executed for political reasons. It was an opportunity for the Turks to rid Turkish territory of a Christian race. World Crisis, Volume 4, page 400. In 1917 the Treaty of San Stefano had promised Armenia the end of its long servitude. Wilson had demanded that the Versailles Treaty include the constitution for an independent Armenia, while the British Prime Minister declared, "Great Britain has decided to liberate the Armenians from the Turkish yoke, to give them back the religious and political freedom, of which, they have been deprived for so long." Everybody at the peace conference was in agreement that Armenia should be restored. Speech after speech stressed the necessity of helping Armenia. But it was all empty verbiage. "The independence and protection of Armenia," said the American delegate, Westerman, "was one of those problems which were talked about without the intention of ever solving it." What happened in Paris, page 147. It was another case of the hypocritical Allies projecting themselves as paragons of virtue and democracy but following a base mercantile path. Armenia was simply a prop to make them feel good in the pompous halls of government and diplomacy. It offered no other interest, not manganese, as in Georgia, no oil as in Mosul, no lobby like the Jews. The British were quick to sidestep the issue by asking Wilson to assume responsibility for the protection and survival of Armenia. Westerman said, "British and French liberal opinion insisted that our delegation be shown the urgent necessity of establishing an American mandate in Armenia." What happened in Paris, page 153. Suddenly the United States was saddled with a problem not of its own making. The Treaty of Sèvres proclaimed Armenia a free and independent state. The President of the United States was entrusted to determine the border between Turkey and Armenia. Wilson, however, did not see this dubious honor for what it was, and, elated, rushed to his typewriter to type his acceptance. "We consider it a Christian duty and a privilege for our government to assume the tutelage of Armenia." Bonsai, Suitors and Suppliants, page 319. The Armenians' joy in finding at last a willing champion was short-lived. As soon as Wilson returned to Washington, he was totally absorbed by local politicking and quickly forgot his noble words. There was simply not any political mileage in the Armenian issue. In fact, in the context of Allied and American politics, it was strictly a non-issue. The genocide of Armenians went on unabated. Churchill acknowledged the tragedy. The Armenian race disappeared from Asia Minor as completely as it is possible for a race to disappear from a territory. The European Crisis, Volume 4, page 399. The American delegate in charge of Armenian affairs recalled. We can say right now that the United States are directly responsible for the tragic fate of Armenia. It was a total sellout. We could have saved the Armenians if we had accepted a mandate over the whole of northern Anatolia. The Armenian mandate had been offered to us and we dodged its obligations. Armenia has been betrayed by the civilized world. The New World, pages 147 to 148, 159. Churchill lamented, "History will search in vain for the name of Armenia." But his government was just as responsible as, if not more than, the well-meaning but weak-minded Wilson. The Americans had not stirred the Middle Eastern pot and had not promised help to one and all. The Armenian survivors were absorbed by the Soviet Union in the arid mountains of the Southern Caucasus. Many died of cold and hunger, while those who survived eked out a grim existence. The American delegate concluded, "The Western world has betrayed the Armenians. Who among us can ever look an Armenian in the eye again?" The Armenian genocide marked the final episode of the Allied intrusion in Middle Eastern affairs. Every people had been used, betrayed, and exposed to massacre. From this mountain of death and tragedy, only the British establishment and the Jews would benefit, only they got what they wanted. In Central Europe, the other center of death and inequity, Germany stood alone. Wounded, menaced, at the end of its resources, it awaited the final verdict. As the drama of Versailles came to an end, Germany waited at the foot of the gallows.